we can gather here together to celebrate the life and legacy of such an extraordinary woman. I am so honored to be here, although it was a direct order from Hazel. It wouldn't have mattered where else in the world I was. I would be here because she was my friend and my mentor. I first met Hazel during the 1992 presidential campaign. Some of us are old enough to remember that. And it was during the primary here in New York that Hazel and a group of Democrats.
Hello, this is Kimberly Irwin. Good evening. This is Race Talks, where we have the very necessary conversation on race and ethnicity. Every third Tuesday of the month on WGXC 90.7 FM, awayfarm.org Enterprise. And of course, why do we have this conversation? So we can combat racism. And especially now in the wake of the onslaught of DEI hatred, basically. So know that this is where we have the conversation and...
No topic is taboo.
No topic is taboo. And I'm going to point to my guest so she can say it too.
No topic is taboo.
Wonderful. And that's our guest talker today, Dr. Rita S. Fierro, and we will forever call her Dr. Rita here. So let's get talking. This month is March, and March, of course, is where we recognize women in Women's History Month. And we are going to pay tribute to a fantastic woman of civil rights movement history, Dr. Hazel Nell Dukes, who just this month on March 1st passed away at the age of 92. This woman is a trailblazer, and you just heard the Honorable Hillary Rodham Clinton, who was the 67th United States Secretary of State, say those incredible words of honor to her in the opening of the show. And that's not all, because we are recognizing women who are firsts also. And you know, Hillary Rodham Clinton was the first in so many ways. But she was the first United States female senator, actually from a southern state. So it's very interesting how we have the South and the North represented in Hillary and in Dr. Dukes. Dr. Dukes actually was born in Alabama in the South, and she came here in her early 20s, I believe. So throughout the show, we will be in different segments paying tribute to her, as I said. But let me just share with you a few things about her. She was a fearless activist, mentor, and leader, and dedicated over seven decades, that's 70 years, folks, to advancing racial justice, voting rights, and the DEI forwarding that the diversity, equity, and inclusivity in systems to make change. Again, we like to recognize first, and one of the first is that she was the first Black woman to work in a Nassau County Attorney's Office in 1966. And many times we think that's not really important. It's not like and it's an attorney's office. What's the big deal about that? Well, today on a show, I think it's called The Afternoon Show in WGXC, we had a pastor who brought on two servants of Hudson and Columbia County, which is in our area, and they were police chief and a undersheriff. So these are two African-American women who have monumental roles, and they were the first in their respective positions. And so something that's normal to some people is very new to us. And that's because of diversity, equity, inclusivity engagements that we now seem to take for granted. There's so many people who are deciding, do we need to march? What are we going to do? And that's a good reason for us having an author of a book, Digging Up Seeds of White Supremacy, on Dr. Rita S. Fierro, who is a social justice consultant, a racial healing expert, along with being the author of that book. She has 30 years of experience studying systemic racism, and she's a change maker, and it forces takes up ways of navigating resistance. For those who are navigating how to navigate resistance to the DEI and its efforts. And again, we will have more YouTube video acknowledgments from those who are important in our state. So we have Governor Kathy Hochul, who will pay tribute to Dr. Dukes, who I lovingly like to refer to as Ma Dukes, because she's a cousin. My cousins, Ronald Dukes and Janet Davis Dukes, were beloved members of the family, and actually shared some words on Facebook that I hope we get to read a little bit of. But let's move on to the terms that we want to talk about today. So we have the civil rights justice, a civil rights movement, which really means government granted protections like equal access to voting, fair treatment under the law, and a freedom from being discriminated against. And so when we think of civil rights, they are somewhat thought of as human rights too, although human rights are rights that are for everyone in every nation because of humanity, and civil rights are usually an acknowledgement of a nation with its people. And so that's kind of the Kimberly Irwin short and definition of that. And certainly I'm going to bring on Dr. Rita so that she can make more of a defining terminology on that. And then social justice, which is a broader ongoing fight for systemic equity across racial, gender, economic, and cultural lines. And on to talk a little bit about how they intersect and why they matter, I'm going to now bring to you our guest talker, Dr. Rita S. Fierro. She's going to share her perspective on the evolving fight for DEI, and of course share a lot of information about who she is and what she's doing today, and just how we might look at ourselves and find out what we can do to make things matter, to maybe be as, well, maybe not as informative and involved as Dr. Dukes was at 92, but certainly having that person as a model of how we may be enlightened and share our energy in this way. So Dr. Rita S. Fierro, or Dr. Rita, as she'd like to be known, please share why you thought being on Race Talks at this time would be helpful to us.
I have been passionate about undoing racism for 30 years now, and I'm up for actually any conversation that I'm called into. So it was an easy yes. I see that you have a long-term commitment to having these conversations, and I think the world is a network of conversations, so we can't transform the world without transforming the conversations we're in, and so I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. We mentioned your book. I like the title of the book. Can you explain a little bit about the title? And she's sharing it right now, and can you bring that the cover up again? Yeah, it's like digging up, not seeds, but pulling up a plant, right? So it's like land, and you have seedlings. It looks like seedlings coming out of the earth, and then a hand. So you can describe it yourself better. Did you choose that cover?
I did. I very much chose the cover.
So explain that, because even the cover itself means something.
This book was, I've been studying systemic racism for 30 years and been kind of, my eyes were opened by Black mothers in Philadelphia who had lost their children to foster care. I spent 2 years for my dissertation work and 10 years after there, listening to their stories and understanding through their eyes.
Recording in progress.
And understanding through their eyes how all the systems were connected and their experience of them and how they felt consistently mistreated by all the systems at the same time. And digging up the seeds, because while the study had been going on for 30 years, in particular, my immersing myself in the world of these mothers, during the phase of like right after COVID, I have this manuscript that I've been working on for 20 years with their stories, and I haven't found the right publisher for it yet. And right before COVID, I had gotten another rejection, basically. And someone said to me, okay, Rita, you got to give this up. You need to start working on something else. And there was a chapter in my dissertation about how three systems, basically after the 70s, adapted to maintain systems of inequality and discrimination, despite the laws that we passed to prevent that. And this person really encouraged me to finally write that chapter up into a book. And I thought it was going to be a 100-page book. It turned out to be, you can see it's kind of thick, 300. And it became this journey of, we know through organizational development that the intention that organizations are built upon permeate and outlive founders. So organizations that were built to create economic security in a time of frenetic lack will have people, employees, even hundreds of years later, who don't prosper and who are under frenetic angst. Organizations that were born from a sense of innovation and courage and possibility, even after the founder dies, maintain some of that character. So it's really like a relationship of the seed to the tree. The intention is the original seed, and then what the organization becomes is this kind of tree that lives new life. And so I asked myself the question, having studied all these systems and having studied all the ways in which they discriminate against Black and brown folk, I asked myself, okay, well, if these are the results and we know the results that break our hearts every single day, what was the intention? Like, what was the seed that was planted that maintains these, that makes these structures so hard to change? And so that was the journey that this book was meant to answer. And the title became Digging Up the Seeds of White Supremacy, because I'm a huge proponent of what you want in your garden. We are responsible for planting what we want in our garden. So I think we have to root up white supremacy, but we also have to be responsible for planting something else.
Well, I like the idea of planting something else. And you meant when you were talking about organizations or, you know, founders who or organizations that outlive their founders, I was thinking of some proactive ones that started in the early 30s, I think. I know that the NAACP, as far as an organization that's, you know, there to provide sustenance for not just African American fort going and but for all people, really. Mm-hmm. Because I know that we see that they're by way of marching, we are now looking at not just making one group being recognized and supported, but all groups. So through the efforts of civil rights movement, with we now have women's movements, you know, the women's rights movements. And of course, we're looking to help people who are immigrants in this way, too. So can you share a little bit more about maybe what you're doing now that would be helpful in guiding us forward?
Yeah, a couple of things. So one of the things that I love to say about this book that I think is really important is that there's a gap in our society, and sometimes it goes along political lines too, between people who see the system and its oppressive mechanisms and people who don't. And oftentimes the folks who don't, besides being predominantly white, because we as white people are trained to not see it, we're actually trained to be blind to it. But besides the race difference between it, I wanted to say that oftentimes I've found people who don't want to talk about systemic racism, even Black and brown folk who don't want to talk about systemic racism, because there are some often don't want to do it because they don't want to take a victim stance. And the conversation around systemic racism has been collapsed with victimization, because of course, when you talk about a system being unjust, it's easy to take a victim stance from it. One of the things that I did with the book was to offer a systemic history, like a history of how the system is built intentionally, systematically, purposefully. And to me, that isn't a victimization stance. It's a powerful stance. It's saying, listen, us as human beings, we created this beast. We created it thinking it would meet certain, and we as predominantly white folks, but actually rich white men, right? So it was created predominantly by a group of people to meet some needs and to resolve certain issues. And just the way we created this, a different system can be created. Like, humans have the capability to shift systems. And 500 years is not that long in the history of humanity. Like, money is only, I think, 5,000 years old, right? Humans are a lot more older. So first of all, I wanted to kick off with that, right? We have the power to shift systems. We have the power to do something different, because ultimately it's humans who created it. It doesn't supersede us. It was built by us, for us. And if it doesn't serve us, it's our responsibility to shift it.
And we want to definitely showcase women who are making that shift happen. Mm-hmm. I want to apologize for people who may know more about the NAACP than what I said was in the 30s it started. But mm-hmm. I have information. The NAACP was founded in February 12th, 1909, yeah. Which is really interesting because that's my birth date. Obviously, not the 1909 part. Otherwise, I age very well. And it's the nation's oldest, largest, and most widely recognized civil rights organization. And like I said, we're recognizing Dr. Hazel N. Dukes. She was the president of the NAACP New York State Conference and a member of the NAACP National Board of Directors, and discussed many an issue that was facing the Black community and the role that women play in politics. And because she did so gracefully and graciously, we're going to have a second segment with the introduction of the Honorable Kathy Hochul, who is governor of New York. She's the first female governor of New York State, which is quite amazing again. And I want to make sure everyone knows that these two were very connected. It was Dr. Dukes who provided the swear her in at the ceremony when she became the governor of New York. So we're going to play a clip from her funeral and the words that Governor Hochul makes note of specifically is the ethnicity of America. And she talks a little bit about her family and that connection.
But I come to say this. Praise be to God, and thank you for giving us Dr. Hazel Jukes. What an extraordinary gift. Her life was a gift to all of us. And I knew her over years.
Are we having an issue with the volume? Okay, while we look at what we're doing there, I will just make a mention that also a group of politicians in New York State paid Dr. Jukes homage.
We deepened our relationship.
Oh, I think it's coming back on. Okay, so let's play the I'll mention what the other state officials say about her in a minute. Well, we can just start off where we left off to.
But I come to say this. Praise be to God, and thank you for giving us Dr. Hazel Jukes. What an extraordinary gift. Her life was a gift to all of us. And I knew her over years, but we really deepened our relationship. It was actually a time of great sorrow for me, just a couple of months after I lost my mother to ALS. And I'd just become a statewide candidate. And I knew I wanted my mom to see that accomplishment. I sat down with Hazel. Guess where? Sylvia's. We sat there and ate biscuits all day long, developing a lifelong addiction for me. And I told her about my mom. She wanted to hear her story. And I said, you know, people don't know this, but my mom and dad started in great poverty. They lived in a trailer park. Dad worked at the steel plant with his own father. My grandpa had started as a migrant farm worker out in South Dakota because they wouldn't hire the Irish. And she didn't know my family's struggles. But I also said, despite their struggles and this huge Irish Catholic family, my mom took me and the other kids to all the civil rights marches in the 60s. And when Dr. King was assassinated, I was a 10-year-old.
Hello.
I knew his story because my mother had me read his life story up until that point. So it was my...
Okay, I think we are experiencing a little bit of sound quality with that audio. So I'm going to go on. We can come... If we have time, we'll come back to that later. I'm hoping that everyone hears me. So what I'm going to do is just read a little bit of the assembly resolution, which is K-160. And this is the resolution that was brought to the floor of the New York State Legislature this month. Mourning the death of Hazel N. Jukes, longtime civil rights stalwart and distinguished member of her community. Whereas there are certain outstanding members of our community who, through their selfless commitment and dedication, have served to better the quality of life in our community and have had a measurable positive impact on the lives of its residents, Hazel N. Jukes was one such individual. And whereas it is with profound sorrow and deep regret that this legislative body records the passing of Hazel N. Jukes, noting the significance of her purposeful life and accomplishments. And whereas Hazel N. Jukes, an early and unwavering crusader for civil rights, who survived personal, professional, and political setbacks to serve for nearly half century as a perennial president of New York State's NAACP, died on Saturday, March 1st, 2025, at her home in Harlem. She was 92. And whereas a fixture on the front lines of the civil rights movement, and eventually an elder stateswoman, Hazel N. Jukes was seen by associates as courageous, implacable, and ardently loyal. She was president of the National NAACP in the early 1990s and headed the organization's New York State Conference from 1977 until her death. I will stop there and move on to our next segment. There is one other thing I wanted to make mention of, and it's very interesting that we are in the month of March, because we have, I think March makes it, we have spring coming in March, right? And when you show the photo of your, or the cover of your book, that's what we think of when we think of spring, right? Growth, or growth of all things that are beautiful or that should flourish. And so I think this is a really great time to get the phone number out to our members so that they can have the opportunity to, in our next segment, call in and talk about or share what they are going to do or how they are inspired to go forth and make some effort to have their voices heard in connections with social justice. Because I know some people were talking about it's a little bit too cold in some states to go out there then. But like, again, this month is going to mark spring. In fact, I think it's a week from now. And so this is the time. Dr. Rita, one of the things that I'd like to have you expound upon is some methods that you use. You mentioned earlier that you would like to share that with the listeners. So this is a great time to go into that.
Yeah, I think this is a very exciting time for those of us who have been in this work for some time. Because as tragic as it is, and as scary as it is, we've passed the threshold of denial. And those of us who have been in this work for 30 years have often been tired of the denial, of the amount of conversations that end with racism. What racism? We don't really have that much racism anymore. We're in a post-racial era.
Right.
That, you know, that became very, very in vogue when Obama was president, but there were many ways of saying it beforehand. And so the having passed through the threshold of denial means that we have to confront that backlash as an integral part of the process. And I love that you started us with Dr. Dukes, because people like Dr. Dukes, like W.E. Du Bois, who co-founded, you know, the NAACP, or Ida B. Wells, if they were here to speak to us today, they would say nothing new, right? Like, backlash has always been an integral part of the process. And what studying African-American history in depth as a history of movements and not just of individual people tells us is that one movement and one organization replaces the other, right? Like, one dies down and then another one takes place. And because each one is built on the ashes of the other. So in terms of practices, one of the theories of change and approaches that I use strongly when I coach or when I consult is that we have to operate at three levels at the same time. I think part of why things look the way they do right now is because we don't operate at three levels. We think we can just take care of ourselves and fix ourselves and racism will disappear. Or we think we can just do it in our organizations and racism can disappear. What it will require for us to actually have an equitable society, for us to actually have a society that isn't based on fear and intimidation, but is actually based on the fullness of human potential, is for us to work at three levels. At the individual level, we have to be in integrity with what we stand for and what our purpose is in the world. And that means learning how to live beyond fear and create what that I call my courage muscles, which means I don't have a practice of going to the gym. So I don't have an expectation to be very toned. I'm not toned. because I don't have a practice of going to the gym. If you don't exercise your courage muscles every single day, you can't expect to be in an unjust situation and know how to speak up in a way that's effective. What it takes, justice and equity have to be built, and they require a fortitude of soul and spirit that isn't just the grace and the softness and the good stuff, which is also there, but it also requires a sturdiness and a strong backbone. I'm thinking about, you know, 6888 and the way with which at the end of the movie, the captain is able to stand up to the man who's looking down upon her and her, I don't have the army terms. Anyway, the group of Black women that she was leading, right? Like she has
battalion?
Battalion, thank you. 6888 battalion, stand and say, you will disrespect them over my dead body, basically. And everybody thinks she's going to get killed for it. And she doesn't. Why? Because truth has a power.
Absolutely.
Pure truth carries a power with it that has, it sort of has this domino effect where jaw drops and the whole room shifts. We need to learn to build our internal consistency, integrity, and alignment to speak with that level of truth. There are various people who did so in the civil rights movement. There are people who do it today as well. And I think as a practice, we have to build that internal integrity so that when we speak, there is power, there is energy, there is reality behind what we're saying. And then we have to, when we do that and we care for ourselves, being aligned also means caring for ourselves very well. So it means having an impeccable self-care practice. What we're living through is designed to re-traumatize, and exhaust us. We have to take impeccable care of ourselves and only ask of ourselves what we can actually do. So when we do what we do it with all of our strength and all of our courage. And when we don't have all of our strength and our courage, we put ourselves to bed and rest.
And pass the baton.
Yes. And when we do that, we teach others to do it as well. So the second level is creating integrity in our teams. When we're in integrity and aligned with who we are and we walk the principles that we stand for our teams to do that as well. I've been a program evaluator for 30 years, which means that I've been evaluating programs with all sorts of equity and justice goals for about 20 years. And I often see social justice organizations treat their own staff like crap.
Wow. Okay.
We can't give what we don't have. Mm-hmm. We can't say that we stand for equity out in the world and then we expect our own workers to work weekends and not take care of their own children and not have free time for their own children. That doesn't work, right? And so that second level, the team has to be nurtured and the team becomes a place where we incubate the world that we want to see. And once those teams are strong and have that same alignment and force and truth that we were talking about, then more and more of those teams can generate together a radical systems change. But it has to be from the inside out. There is no other way.
Well, as I'm listening to you, I'm like flexing my muscles because I feel like I have the talk muscle gene, but I also have the walk muscle gene where I, you know, I walk the walk that I talk. So, but we do get tired and sometimes we're not as bold as we would like to be because something is holding us back. Sometimes it's our jobs. Sometimes it's our family. Sometimes it's what I hate to even acknowledge, but fear, right? We have the fear of not maybe being successful, but failing. And we do understand that if we don't try, we won't even have the opportunity to be successful. But some of us don't try because of the fear in itself.
Yes.
So go ahead.
So my question and what I work with my clients for, which is why I say I'm a social justice consultant and coach, is how do we generate a social justice strategy that allows you to do something so your integrity with the part you're in integrity with the part of you that's like, this is unacceptable, without necessarily having to be bold in a self-destructive way. Like, activism and social change and change making doesn't just, and transformation doesn't just happen from the person who speaks out and says, well, you all are crazy. Like, that looks cute. And, you know, our movies, again, our movies support that as the face of social justice. But actually, I would argue that what transformation takes is a lot of silent action over the course of years and decades. And it's a lot of one-on-one conversations and a lot of relationship building and a lot of work that sometimes people don't even recognize as work.
What I'm listening to, because again, this is Women's History Month, so I am going to do shout outs for women. And in this case, yes, moms. Because what I'm hearing is how a mom treats their child can be seen as social justice work. If you take good care and responsibility for your child, that way they can be strong and be bold and be courageous, even if they're in a space at any given time that doesn't seem to be supportive.
Absolutely. So much of internalized white supremacy is emotional immaturity. That's why one of my mentors says, you white women seem like children to us. She's a black woman.
Oh, yes. Sounds familiar. we did say honoring Dr. Dukes, and she's there. she has lots of family. Might even get to share that part that Governor Hochul actually talks about her as finding her as family. But go on, because we do have that. Did you want? We have that queued. We have that queued in the call-in number if we can get that in. But I just want you to go ahead, Dr. Rita, and say what you were going to say, because you were like filling me. So I want to go ahead.
White fragility is instilled, in particular in white women, but white folks in general. We believe that we can't face certain things or we'll break apart. I often say, I don't think we can talk people out of white fragility. Those are things that our family has instilled in us, so we can only heal from it. And we have to be able to do that work. But it often comes across to folks of color as just being like immature, spoiled, or childish, because folks of color live in a world every day that isn't just, that isn't fair. And so when we as white folks who assume everything's going to go fine in our lives come up against a situation, or we assume that everything will be hard except for this thing that should be easy, when that one thing that we come across that we expect to be easy isn't easy, we kind of temper tantrum and go into this, you know, the world isn't fair.
Sounds like MAGA world now.
Yes. Yes.
That's the blowback on DEI, where they look around and it's not all white and it's not all male. And oh my goodness, they have to find a foothold in this new reality, which is a reality that's for everyone. And it's just not wanting to be recognized. Let's have Garrett Roche, the host of the Roche Solid Truth podcast, come in and share the call number for WGXC phone in access and hopefully the short video of Governor Hochul addressing and honoring Ma Dukes.
Positively, always proud to be your producer, Kimberly. Thank you ever so much. And if anyone would like to call in, weigh in on this discussion, build the bridge of positivity, it's 518-622-2598 and press option 3. Again, that's 518-622-2598 and press option 3. And all are definitely welcome to donate to WGXC via WGXC.org, because we could use a little upgrade here in the equipment, as you can hear. We're banishing gremlins as we speak. And here we go with the Governor Hochul clip that Ms. Irwin just promised us.
But I come to say this. Praise be to God, and thank you for giving us Dr. Hazel Dukes. what an extraordinary gift. Her life was a gift to all of us. And I knew her over years, but we really deepened our relationship. It was actually a time of great sorrow for me, just a couple of months after I lost my mother to ALS. And I'd just become a statewide candidate. And I knew I wanted my mom to see that accomplishment. I sat down with Hazel. Guess where? Sylvia's. We sat there and ate biscuits all day long, developing a lifelong addiction for me. And I told her about my mom. She wanted to hear her story. And I said, you know, people don't know this, but my mom and dad started in great poverty. They lived in a trailer park. Dad worked at the steel plant with his own father. My grandpa had started as a migrant farm worker out in South Dakota because they wouldn't hire the Irish. And she didn't know my family's struggles. But I also said, despite their struggles and this huge Irish Catholic family, my mom took me and the other kids to all the civil rights marches in the 60s. And when Dr. King was assassinated, I was a 10-year-old. I knew his story because my mother had me read his life story up until that point. So it was my mother who instilled in me this sense of righteousness and the fight for justice. And when she heard that story, she took my hand and she says, I'll be your mother. I'll be your mother. Now, it meant a lot to me, but I didn't know that I now had about 1,000 siblings. Because apparently she's the mother to everybody. Anybody here not Hazel's child? Ronald, I'm sorry. There's a whole lot of us. You have the biggest family in history.
Okay, so I did mention mothers, right? And of course, everyone affectionately called her Ma or Mama Dukes. We want to be able to let people come in and share some thoughts. But I was thinking, Dr. Rita, and I should have prepped you before we played that clip. But do you have any words of wisdom for your mom?
Well, I think women have always mothered community. Mm-hmm. And what our world is thirsting for is men who nurture community.
Say that one more time.
I think mothers have always nurtured not just their families, but also community. Mm-hmm. And what our world is thirsting for is men who nurture community.
So our men world is thirsting for it?
Yes, I think so. For authentic community, not
power. Okay.
There's plenty of power.
So I was like, I don't quite understand.
Yeah, I think most men, in particular white men, are raised to see their nuclear families and their friends and families as the tribes that they need to protect, but not a wider community. So I see this in my own family. I could see that the men are overwhelmed. It's like, I can provide for these three people, but don't ask me to think about the needs of anybody else because I'm overstretched. Like, they have a minimum capacity for, while women have always cared for community with no limit, like, women are like, you know, this cousin needs this. And part of it is who we are as women, and that's okay, because women can think are bigger multitaskers, think more amply. Then that's the case. Men don't have to do it if they can't think that way, but then there needs to be an acknowledgement of the fact that women do. So I'm thinking about a gorgeous article I came across while I was studying for the book. In the Iroquois Constitution, which our Constitution took some pieces from, we often think of Native Americans as the male chiefs being in power.
Yes.
Because the male chiefs were the ones who led, like carried the staffs or whatever the symbology of. And one of the things that the Iroquois Constitution says is that the elder women had the power to depose any chief who was not serving the interests of the community, of the tribe. So what would our politics look like if the old women on the block who raised, you know, the person who becomes a politician, had the capability of saying, you are up there serving your own needs and not the community that voted for you. Get your butt back over here. Like, what, how would our world be different? How would our politics be different? Women have always thought more broadly. Men are more focused. So in a metaphor that we often use, it was like in traditional societies, in indigenous societies, women would look out at the community and say, okay, this person has a fever, this person has a rash, that person has something else, right? And then say to the man, go up that, and the man's like, I want to accomplish something. And the woman's like, okay, go up that mountain and get me this herb, and this herb. And the man would come back down and feel like a hero. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And that's wonderful, because he gets to have his sense of accomplishment, but it's actually the woman who's looking for the needs of the whole. That's what our world is thirsty for, is men who create a healthy masculine, which is create their sense of accomplishments by taking care of and like looking out for the needs of the whole instead of just looking out for themselves.
So if I were to say that my thirst is of seeing a woman in the United States as leader of our nation, would that be antithesis to that vision or what you've stated?
No, I think it could look a lot of different ways. I think it may more likely look the way you just described than the way I just described, because our institutions foster, as hard as it is to have a woman president of our country, it's easier to have a woman president than to establish a system where the elders can tear down our politicians. So I'm with you on it.
Yeah.
If I were to build something new, if I were to build a new organization, I would consider, okay, what are other structures of accountability that we could actually create if I were starting from scratch? But within the context of what we have, absolutely.
Yeah, and when you mentioned in the initial segment, you talked about your book and how you were looking at the systemic, the ability for the organization to make that change. If it's made from within, and the founders are no longer there. So I'm kind of fast putting in the founding fathers of our nation, who of course are no longer here, but in place of them are similar founders. I know that when we look at planting, if we keep planting this in the same location, then the earth isn't as fertile. So we need to change or change crops in that area so that the fertility can come back to the soil. And I'm thinking that's kind of what you're talking about, where we can move in. So women can move in, or female ideas or ideas that are representative of like what you're talking about with the Native American population, maybe female aura, something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Except that systems don't change because people change. Like our laws, our constitution, right? Again, coming back to the seed, the analogy of the seed in the tree, even the common saying, right? The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. If we consider that our constitution was written by a number of slaveholders who had the gall of writing in the Constitution that, you know, all men are created equal, forgetting the rights of women, or forgetting, right? Ignoring the rights of women and ignoring the rights of enslaved Africans, right? Like, our country was founded on a huge gap and lack of integrity. And what we see is the perpetuation of this narrative. It's the same tree, the same seed. We clip the branches, they come back, they grow in the same exact way. And nature is a huge teacher in this regard, because we know that the DNA of the tree and the DNA of the seed carry almost the exact same DNA. Like every cell in the tree has the DNA information of the seed. So there's something about how we mirror when the things are similar. So sometimes people think that we can change systems by changing laws. I think this is the huge fallacy, unfortunately, of parts of the civil rights movement. Systems don't change through laws. Mm. What we see through organizational change is that systems change because the old system starts dying and people start wanting to jump ship. And they look around and they say, what the heck is the alternative? Because this is clearly a ship that's sinking. And if when they look around and most of the people want to jump ship, they find a group of pioneers who's been working at it for decades, who saw the insanity way before the ship started sinking, what happens is that those group of pioneers have created an alternative. And so to your point, which is how, you know, electric cars came about, right? Like, we've had an electric car since 1950. There are people who have been experimenting with electric cars for 70 years. But why are they in commerce now? Because we started talking about the ending of the provision of oil. And so then the car industry started investing in electric cars, and they did the kind of last stretch that was needed for it to actually be in all of our hands. I hate doing that. That's a common example that I use. I hate doing it now for obvious reasons, for obvious political reasons.
Yeah,
but for the, it's still a good example.
The car brand that we shall not mention.
He who shall not be named. So to your point about, you know, women planting new things, yes, and there's a level of change that happens at an institutional level. We have to also accept that there's only so far we're going to be able to change our politics without changing something new. And honestly, I wrote an article a few years ago about changing the Constitution altogether. We could do a 30-year process to rewrite the... We have one of the oldest constitutions in the world. And I bet you with everything that's happening, it would not be as hard to get a bilateral consensus and process going on rewriting the Constitution.
Well, Dr. Rita, I've already shared this with my friends. We need a 21st century Constitution.
Yes.
I think it's time. Yes. And because we have a group of people now in power who tends to want to just take down the organization along with the systems that pervade it, we might have this opportunity, but we do have to work together. And I want to share one of the things that I think is important for women to get together too and support each other. I think the idea, and I think you mentioned it earlier, that we sometimes fear change in the sense that we don't see that we deserve it. So, you know, some people, some Black people, some African-American male and females are saying, okay, let's do away with DEI, because they're believing the hype that, oh, well, if the DEI is in process, then we are only going to get hired or be in that place due to DEI. And of course, that's hogwash, but people are believing that. So I think getting together and showing and not alienating or discounting men. Men are necessary, especially young boys, and because they are our future too. Young people are our future, and with their minds goes systems, right? So that's why moms and dads are integral. And of course, everyone having a voice in the family, so that everyone has a voice in the nation, right? We are going to slowly run out of time, so I want to make sure we do get our last clip in, if possible. I'm seeking to see if we have anyone calling. Have we looked to see if there's anyone on the line?
Well, the clip is 150% possible, Kimberly, and no one's called yet because nothing's popped up. Pop up on the monitor there where.
So then let's get the last clip in.
Are
we going to end with the clip?
Where your guest is calling in, but it's still 518-622-2598, option 3. If anyone would like to get a few words in the last 5 minutes of the show. In the meantime, we're going to play your last clip here by...
I think we should hold off on the clip because I think it's a good idea for us to have a sign off and then have the clip after, you know,
certainly
leading out.
That's perfect.
Maybe.
Thank you. We're at 7:55 now, 5 minutes.
So let's just make sure I get what that clip is, because we had some issues with what we're going to share. That's the clip of
Reverend Al Sharpton.
And his goal is to share with us
his memory on Dr. Hazel Dukes.
See, perfect way to end. Because he's a civil rights icon. Some people can take him. Some people would like to throw something at him. But that just makes all of what he does more fiery, more potent. And that this particular person is in so many avenues, in so many venues, I should say, in civil rights movement, and is so knowledgeable of so many civil rights leaders. I think it's an encouragement to, or I should say apropos, and a New Yorker, apropos to have him share words about the iconic Dr. Hazel Nell Dukes. So we're going to end with that. Usually we end with music, but we will end with that. And until now, I mentioned that you, Dr. Rita, would be able to address our audience, sharing anything that you would like to share with them, also letting them know how to reach you and how to contact you. And I will say that if she says anything very quickly, know that if you go to www.kimberlyirwin.me, you will find ways to just click on some of those LinkedIn connections or social media connections that she may share with you now.
Beautiful. Easy ways to connect with me. I mean, you can find me on LinkedIn, Rita S. Fierro. My website is drritawrites.com. That's D-R-R-I-T-A and writes as in writing, W-R-I-T-E-S .com. I will be speaking and presenting teaching two workshops at the White Privilege Conference. It's March 25th to the 26th in Hartford, Connecticut this year. We are celebrating the 25th conference. So if you are looking for people to have conversations about racism and anti-racism with, or if you are puzzled about all the backlash and are looking for your posses and your tribe to connect with, and even just stay positive and see the direction for the next few years, or just the next month or the next day. I really invite you to come. There are some amazing presenters. And as people who have been doing this work for 25 years, you'll find a number of people who have a level of expertise and lived experience that will certainly stand out. So come if you're a white person looking for other white people to have this conversation with who understand you. Come if you're a person of color who's looking for some white people who don't drive them nuts. Come if you're looking for your people. It's family.
Thank you. I love that you said it's family. I want to thank my family, includes Dr. Hazel Dukes' family, her son Ronald Dukes, and son and daughter-in-law, Janet Davis Dukes. And I want to just share with everyone. Oh, and thank you, Dr. Rita, for being on the show today and sharing with us all of your history and knowledge on social justice. And I want to thank the audience or listeners for listening. And definitely check us out on YouTube if you are interested, and following more LBJ, Love, Beauty, Joy.
And if you don't believe that there were northern bigots that we had to fight, all you got to do.